Welcome to the program, Richard. Now, the anger that you feel about the modern university, and I've already read a couple of paragraphs of your book earlier in the program, the state of play that you described so vividly seems to have begun, in my memory, with John Dawkins when he was Minister for Education. So that's the late 1980s, is it not?
It is indeed, yes. I don't think it's so much anger that I feel. You know, I was listening to your previous speaker. I think I have more of a sadness about it all, actually.
Not despair, I hope, because, in fact, your book does go on to say, look, we've got to change things. You're not giving up, are you?
Absolutely not. And what's clear from the academics I spoke to, and I spoke to about 60 or so academics, many of whom are sort of retired, many emeritus professors, many younger academics currently in the system across a whole range of disciplines. And what came across really consistently is, yes, they're angry. Yes, they're disillusioned to a certain degree. Yes, they're disenchanted. But they all have a very deep passion for the idea of a university, but they want a different sort of university.
I was quoting inputs, outputs, targets, key performance indicators, quality assurance, corporate discipline, brand distinctiveness, market share. Now, whatever John Dawkins wanted to do, he did sort of pit the universities against each other, didn't he?
Well, he sure did. You know, it's very interesting because what I actually pinned Dawkins' views down to, or to whom, is actually Milton Friedman. I had the opportunity the other day of actually going back to an essay that Milton Friedman wrote in 1955. I can't quite recall the title at this point, but it is absolutely remarkable the similarity between the ideas that Dawkins was peddling about universities and what's happened subsequently, not only in relation to, you know, things like, you know, student loans, but also the deregulation of universities. It's very much in keeping with what Milton Friedman actually talked about all those years ago.
Well, I know many people in the Labour Party, you know, many senior people in the party regard the Dawkins innovations as a national tragedy, but out of it, the Sandstones did all right, as you point out, Melbourne, Sydney, UQ, but the Gumtree universities didn't do well at all.
No, that's absolutely right, and I think the Sandstones continue to do very well. I was very interested the other day to read in Campus Review, one of the main sort of publications that academics read these days, where one of the senior vice chancellors of one of the G8s was actually saying, insisting that the whole new regime of quality assurance should actually be applied not to G8s themselves, because in fact they're doing rather well, but in fact to those lesser universities in the regions. They didn't actually use that terminology, but certainly that was the inference.
Well, one of the things that I've talked about on the program for decades, which disturbs me, is that what I thought universities were about, you know, the lofty scholarship, not wildly practical in many cases, but absolutely vibrant in terms of, you know, the quality of national thinking, has been pushed aside by some of the most ludicrous pseudo-courses that are offered by universities in a desperate attempt to shore up student numbers to balance the books.
Well, you're absolutely right, you know, and the evidence is there for all of us to see. We see, you know, both in the United States, Britain, and in Australia, a bizarre, you know, spectacularly bizarre range of courses which are emerging. You know, I've got a list here in front of me, actually, because I anticipated.
Well, read a couple of really bad ones.
Well, for example, if you're in the UK, you can actually do David Beckham studies, which, you know, I mean, I would knock it necessarily. I think it'd be quite riveting. You know, this is probably under the rubric of cultural studies. We then have, you know, United States units on alien sex. You can actually do a unit on Judge Judy. Going down my list, in Australia, you can do casino studies. You can do surfing studies. There's a course on UFOs.
I remember once learning that McDonald's had a hamburger university and laughing like mad at it. Well, of course, we now have hamburger university type courses within our universities.
Well, we sure do. Actually, my very favourite is a course called The Phallus, you know. And I'd enroll instantly on that one if it was any university I attended, and courses on cyber porn and so forth. These are all riveting courses, but it obviously gives rise to the question.
Which universities offer those courses? I want to do a post-grad.
Yes, indeed, indeed. But, you know, I mean, quite seriously, when you look at these sort of the range of these courses, and, it, you know, implicitly you could argue a case for these actually, you know, sitting under the heading of, you know, cultural studies or whatever it might be. But when you have these kind of courses emerging, and then you see, on the other hand, the demise of things like social ecology, peace and conflict studies, philosophy, certain languages, classics.
You know, oh, you silly old-fashioned thing, you.
Now, I'm a fossil.
This is interesting. You felt yourself slide into disillusionment. Quote, it wasn't so much the drudgery of the business model that irked me. I found its application at the universities bemusing because it was administered so amateurishly.
Well, indeed, you know, and one of the problems with the universities, of course, is that many of the people actually end up in senior management positions and middle management positions were once themselves, you know, full-time academics, some of whom were devoted to research and teaching and others not as much. But they go on to these positions, you know, and I often have wondered why. You know, why would you want to, you know, enter a university presumably with the passion that you have for research, teaching, and, you know, naively perhaps wanting to change the world, and then find yourself located, albeit on a salary of, you know, several hundred thousand dollars at very senior management levels, to actually undertake, preside over this cult, this sort of corporate culture, which is all about, you know, throughputs, outputs, and more recently, impact.
I wasn't aware that standardization was such a bugbear. Tell us about unit information guides, Bruce.
Yeah, well, look, I became a bit obsessed with unit information guides because, you know, I'm a sort of a romantic, really, I guess, and I could be accused of being elitist, which I probably am, you know. I attended university in England, the equivalent to one of our sort of red brick universities in Australia. And in those days, you know, our unit information guides were, you know, a grand total of four or five very poorly typed pages, usually on pink, yellow, or green paper. These days in universities, you'll find these things called unit information guides, which ostensibly are meant to convey information to students about the content of courses. But they actually now run to something like, in some cases, about 30 or 40 pages, and academics are very fond of talking about them as if they're sort of legal contracts. I mean, they're no such thing, of course, but this is all part of the fear, you know, that academics have in relation to upsetting students these days. But what we find in these is an amazing amalgam of information, you know, and the most bizarre of which are these tables, which you find cross-tabulations of things involving aims, objectives, and things called graduate attributes. Now, graduate attributes have emerged over the last several years in universities, and they've been spectacularly ignored, really, in terms of any critical inquiry by academics. You know, we largely go along with these things and include them. But in these matrix, in this complicated matrix, which forms the very core of these unit information guides, this cross-tabulation of aims, objectives, and graduate attributes becomes a very complicated affair. And actually, I have to say that when I began writing about universities critically or in a sort of semi-satirical way, my very first short essay was actually about whether students actually read these unit information guides. And lo and behold, they probably read one paragraph if you were lucky.
We're discussing Wackademia by Richard Hill. Richard, the nearest I got to university was going past Melbourne's in a Swanson Street tram. But I wanted to be at university. They seem such wonderful places. There were places of political uprisings and revolutions and student radicalism. This whole thing we're describing was implemented without any, as far as I can remember, academic uprisings. Why did the scholars, the academics, the professors, etc., cop it?
That's a really interesting question, and the answers are very complex. You know, look, this ideology, as you pointed out, the Dawkins reforms were really the outgrowth of a neoliberal ideology with all the intersections that involved, you know, including economic rationalism, managerialism, and other outgrowths of that particular point of view. I think that a whole number of things were associated with the emergence of this new ideology. One of the central things, of course, was the emergence of line management and new forms of regulation of academics. And amongst all the things that academics actually complain about, and they do complain about rather a lot, with considerable justification, I have to add, one of the central things they actually complain about is the degree of over-regulation and the powers which have actually been accorded to heads of school, to deans.
Are you saying their energies were sapped, you know, progressively by the overload of work they had to do? Is that why they didn't, you know, rip up the pavestones and occupy the vice chancellor's office?
Yes, it is in part to do that. I mean, one of the chapters in the book, I talk about, you know, cultures of busyness, you know, and this the headless chicken syndrome, the endless running around and not being able to cope, particularly with the emergence of online education and the massification of education. In other words, you know, the huge new numbers which of students who've come into the university. And it's not just simply that we have large numbers of students. You know, in 1990, the figures were less than, you know, 500,000. Now the figures top a million and rising as we speak, but it's that the entry requirements for students to come into universities have been so rendered flexible and in many cases repeatedly lowered to allow students to come in, and this has caused enormous problems for academics.
Well, on the other side, and right around the world, we've done quite a bit on this lately. We've got a vast number of highly educated, whether they're well educated is another question, highly educated kids with you know, with degrees,
yes,
who then find there's no jobs for them.
Yes, indeed.
And meanwhile, the universities keep pumping them out. How do we deal with this paradox?
Well, indeed so. Look, and a lot of my evidence for that is actually anecdotal. You know, I haven't got it at hand, but I do know that we are heading for problems, and those problems are not simply to do with the numbers of graduates that we're pumping out of the system. It's to do with what's also going on in that system. What we hear regularly, repeatedly, on the pages of The Australian, Campus Review, The Advocate, and other outlets that inform academics is regular complaints about course content, the dissatisfaction of overseas students about courses they attend here, particular concerns around business courses, and particular concern more recently about journalism courses. Now, these are not just one-off complaints. These are regular complaints. If you pick up...
Oh, they're deafening. They're absolutely deafening.
Indeed so. And they're repeated regularly in the papers.
Okay. You're calling for a reignition of the spirit of the university. What should academics be doing, albeit belatedly?
Well, a number of things. I think there's a number of things happening for academics. I talk about moral pragmatism in the book. Look, you know, it would be extraordinarily difficult in this overregulated environment in which you have this culture of line management to simply, you know, walk away or to revolt. Obviously, in that awful parlance, academics have to be strategic. But what I think that actually means in practice is really thinking creatively about opening up spaces for themselves to return to the core business of academic life, which is research and teaching. It isn't necessarily, you know, sitting on endless committees, although I do recognise that's an important part of university governance, and it isn't certainly filling in those endless forms and being subject to endless reviews, which academics complain about.
So they should be, arguing for change, and they should be trying to identify common ground with their colleagues?
Indeed so. Look, I mean, and they are arguing for change. You know, there are many cases of academics publicly, privately, and otherwise arguing for change. But many of them are actually expressing their discontent by actually leaving the profession and discouraging other people from entering that profession. One of the most profound comments I actually received whilst researching this book was from a very senior academic in politics. I won't mention the university for fear of compromising this person.
Just whisper it into the mic so only I can hear.
Well, as long as you don't tell anybody, yeah, Philip. Yeah. But this person actually said that he would hesitate. No, actually stronger than that. He said he would never recommend to any of his PhD candidates to enter university. He would only take on PhD candidates they promised not to work in university. Such was his disillusionment with the system.
Oh, dear, oh, dear, oh, dear. Mm. Okay. What about the courses? What about the fact that so many of the courses are verging on the idiotic?
Oh, look, you know, what I've presented so far is a very negative picture, and I can feel people probably bristling out there and saying, well, what about all the good stuff? And what I want to say very strongly and unequivocally is, you know, look, there are excellent academics in the system, excellent research going on, civically engaged research which produces enormous good, highly utilitarian.
Well, I get a lot of these academics on the program.
And you do.
I have to say that sometimes I find I'm terribly excited by what's happening.
Yes, indeed. And I am too, And, you know, my critique of universities, and I actually approach this, look, I'm a very reluctant public figure, and I'm becoming a public figure because I've written this stuff, and I've written in The Australian and the Campus Review and so forth and other publications. But I wrote it because I sensed that the corridor chatter, the complaints were not being aired publicly. And these complaints are not infrequent. They are the daily flow of academic conversation in these institutions.
I observed during the darkest days of the ABC, and I won't mention the name Jonathan Shire, where the whole ABC just collapsed internally. Rather than us all getting together in great collegiate rage, people just sort of rolled over. It was a terrible thing to witness. But that's all changed now. The ABC is now cutting edge, and we're all vibrant and energetic and reinvigorated. So don't just retreat behind office doors, you say. Don't moaning and groaning. In your words, get out and change the world.
Well, I think so, and I think if there's one recommendation I'd make, and I actually got this recommendation from somebody in an English university, is when you go to a staff meeting and things like graduate attributes are raised or there's a proposal for a cranky unit, argue your case. Never let anything pass, and turn everything into an argument and a debate.
Got to go. Writer and academic Richard Hill, with one L, is the author of Wackademia, published by New South. On our next, a special interview with Julian Assange, where he's still hoping to avoid extradition to Sweden, but can his lawyers get that case reopened? We'll hear from Julian's own personal lips what he thinks of his prospects. But stick around now for the news, and we will see you later.